The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, 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 all persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Be seated. We want to welcome everyone to the Fourth Circuit this morning. We have four interesting cases and look forward to the arguments of counsel. In the first case, number 114992, United States versus Abramsky, Ms. Overstreet.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Pleased to hear from you.
Good morning. As the court is aware, I'm Rhonda Overstreet, and I have been appointed to represent Bruce Abramsky on this appeal. As indicated in the documents that have been filed in the joint appendix, Mr. Abramsky was originally indicted on two counts and entered a conditional plea of guilty to both of those counts. The first count is 18 U.S.C. 922A6. The second count is 18 U.S.C. 924A1A. Interesting enough, the facts leading to these indictments generally are not in contest between Mr. Abramsky and the government.
Do you admit a violation of the statute?
No, I do not.
Not even a technical violation of the statute?
No.
Okay. And that's because why?
It is our position, Your Honor, there's not even a technical violation, because in order to have even a technical violation of this statute, I think the court, as indicated in Polk in the Fifth Circuit, has got to look at Mr. Abramsky's intent. Did he have that intent to falsely mislead the dealer when he acquired the firearm? And in that, did he have some criminal intent? I would submit to the court that Mr. Abramsky did not have.
Did he admit that when he pled guilty?
If you look at the plea colloquy with Judge Conrad in the appendix, Mr. Abramsky indicates that at the time he purchased the firearm, he did not know that he was committing a violation of the statute as it was written. He felt that he had taken all the steps necessary with his uncle, Mr. Alvarez.
But he did attest that he was the actual buyer, right?
Yes, sir,
he did. And doesn't the form indicate that the actual buyer, he's not the actual buyer if he's acquiring the firearm for another person?
There is in the fine print on the back of the form. I think we have.
I asked you about the fine print. Isn't that on the form?
Yes, sir, that is.
And so if the fact is he was acquiring it for another person, that's not a violation of the statute?
Your Honor, we submit that it under this fact scenario.
Based on what is that not a violation? The form says, are you the actual purchaser? He checked yes. And the form says, if you're acquiring it for another person, you're not the actual purchaser. And that seems to me pretty clearly a violation. Now, if you want to claim somehow, Did he not violate the form? You can maybe claim that somehow that's not a violation of the statute. But what is what he said and did on the form, you assert that's correct?
Your Honor, I can't run from the fact that he checked box 11A that says
Didn't answer my question.
He answered a yes. He didn't check it. He said yes.
Correct. He did check it as yes.
So why isn't that a violation? I want you to go to that argument. Let's just get it straight, though. He did, in fact, misstate on the form that he was the actual purchaser as that was defined on the form, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And so I was trying to give you some leeway to say a technical violation,
well,
but you say that a misstatement on the form is not a violation of the statute.
I think, again, you can't look at it, with all due respect, in that vacuum. I think we have to, as was argued in the brief.
What are you saying? Are you claiming that you got an affirmative defense to this, if he's really getting it for someone who doesn't have a disability of some kind?
I don't know that I can say that that's an affirmative defense per se. I'm using the analysis that
the
Fifth Circuit
lied to the firearms dealer.
On the face of the form, he checked. Correct.
I'm the actual buyer, purchaser of the transfer of the firearm. And then he went and sold it to his uncle.
As he had prearranged.
He had prearranged with the uncle to acquire it for his uncle, correct.
Got it for his uncle, who wasn't disqualified, apparently, by being a... He wasn't a felon or anything.
He was not a prohibited...
I mean, the uncle was all right. The uncle could have gone and bought it himself and told the truth about it. He might have gotten a different price. There was a discount or something allegedly involved. but the firearms, the statement on the form, the 4473 form, is false. You have to admit that.
Great. He's not the actual...
That Folks case seems to say, might give you an argument, there's a defense to this.
Yes.
If the real buyer, who's correct, the uncle, is a qualified buyer.
And that's our position.
Your man's the straw man, right?
Our position is Alvarez, the uncle, was not a prohibited person. Obransky's not a prohibited
person.
Neither one of them are. So it's our position.
You're saying he's the real buyer. Your man's the front guy. He's the straw person.
He's acquiring it for his uncle, yes.
But it's called a straw transaction, isn't it?
It's a straw transaction, but we contend it's not a straw purchase that, as Congress intended for this statute to address. The material misrepresentation here, I submit, has to be a misrepresentation that is intended to deceive the firearms dealer about the legality of the entire transaction. 922A6 is designed...
Well, why isn't the firearms dealer entitled to know who's buying the gun? He is. That's what the question is.
But he's entitled to know, but under this fact scenario, as the Fifth Circuit pointed out in Polk, we don't have
the
two...
The Fifth Circuit?
The Fifth Circuit in
the
Polk.
That's the best case you got.
That's the best
and
case I've got.
And there's three or four other circuits that have gone the other way.
That is correct. And what's interesting about the other circuits is when they do their analysis is looking at the facts that I'm asking this court to look at. They don't look at it in a vacuum. They look at the individuals that were involved in the transaction, the purpose of the transaction, the motives of the transaction. In the Morales case...
But if you assert that you... I want to be sure. I don't think it is your position that you have an affirmative defense. That's not your position, is it? Because that would not be the appropriate basis for a conditional plea, would it? That you have a defense? Your plea has to be that the statute doesn't apply in these circumstances.
Correct.
So you're not asserting...
It's not an affirmative defense. I'm finding myself in a box here, but...
You're just saying that the way that, although some other circuit may say you may have a defense or something, that's not your position in this case. Your position is that under these facts, the statute just does not apply.
That has been the argument that was made by trial counsel.
Well, is that your argument now?
Yes, sir, it has to be.
Are you talking about Mr. Cleveland?
Yes, sir.
He entered a conditional plea.
Yes, sir.
And then did he put the brief together? His name's on the brief.
He did, and he did the reply brief.
And then you got into it.
Yes, sir. Mr. Cleveland just went on the bench. He's now a general district court judge.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Right. So you're handling it here. You're the only one we got.
Yes, sir.
You're his assignee.
I'm it.
Totally and completely.
Totally and completely for today's purposes.
I was afraid you were going to say once he found out the panel, he handed the case off to you.
No, sir, for that, he probably would not have done that, but I'll be sure to tell him who's on the panel when I return to Roanoke. Today, it is a
you're
very interesting...
You're just playing the cards you were dealt. We understand
yes,
that.
Yes, sir, I have. It's an interesting fact scenario, I'll say
are
that.
Are you willing to abandon, and since you are that, what about these search warrants? Are you willing to say that they're not... They don't have anything to do with this?
That they don't have anything to do with this? No, sir. I'm not willing to abandon.
You want to abandon the search warrant claims?
No.
Well, I mean, all we're arguing here is this form thing. We've been arguing about the 4473.
We wouldn't even have the 4473, I submit, if the agents had not went in illegally and seized the evidence.
So you're saying there was an illegal search?
Yes,
well,
sir.
Well, why aren't you arguing that first? Then if there's an illegal search... You don't get to this.
Yeah, I'm with you definitely. Definitely, I'll start
jumping
there.
Jumping right up to this thing here, and you're saying, well, they shouldn't have been searching the man's home and had never known about the uncle up in Pennsylvania that bought the gun.
Yes, sir, that is correct. I submit that the entry into Mr. Obransky's home on Iron Ridge Road.
Now, there are two search warrants.
Correct.
And you don't, I'm going to pin you down here.
Yes, sir.
The first search warrant was for his parents' home.
That is correct.
You don't claim that's a Callaway, Virginia. You don't claim there's anything wrong with that one.
I will rely on the arguments Mr. Cleveland stated in the brief on that. My biggest issue is with the second one, because that's how they got a hold
of it. Well, the second one is at his home.
And correct.
It's July 19th.
Yes.
It was a couple weeks, 3 weeks later. And you're saying that's the one that's bad.
Yes.
Under the Constitution.
Yes, that is the one I take the main issue
the
with.
Judge,
yes.
The judge, they got a search warrant from a federal judge.
Yes.
And went into the home and found this bag, money bag, with a receipt in it for $400.
Yes.
For a Glock.
A money bag that the search warrant specifically says we do not want to seize any money bags. We've already seized money bags on the first search. We're not here to seize money bags. That's very clearly stated.
Well, if the officers are there and they find evidence of a crime, it wouldn't even have to have anything to do with bank robberies or guns or anything, wouldn't it? If they run into evidence of a crime, can't they take it? If they're lawfully in that spot?
If they were lawfully in the spot,
if they were lawfully in there, the judge gave them a warrant which commanded them to go into the home and search.
But it's our position
there
wasn't...
They were there pursuant to a directive of a judge.
They were there pursuant to the directive, but our first attack is that there wasn't even sufficient probable cause for the search warrant to be issued based upon the affidavit as it was sworn out and submitted. But
okay.
They're
so
there.
You're saying the judge was wrong to issue the
yes.
thing?
He initially was wrong.
And if you're right on all that, then this 4473 thing is moot.
Exactly right. It all goes away. Yes.
But in any event, if you get to the 4473, it's not a crime.
Correct.
Because you rely on the Fifth Circuit case.
Yes, I do. I think that this case is factually distinguishable from all the other cases that the government has cited, because in those cases, again, there is evidence of either a prohibited person or an unlawful motive, some unlawful, illegal reason why the firearm was being acquired. That is simply not the case on these facts. And if you read the congressional intent behind the Gun Control Act, Mr. Obransky is the last person I would submit that Congress ever intended to be snagged by this particular statute. If the court has no other questions, I will rely on my brief and allow the government, and then I'll respond.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. You have some time. Stay back.
Thank you.
Mr. Booth? You usually come up here with the government on all the hard cases. Is this one of them?
I hope it isn't. Judge King and members of the court. On the first issue, it's our submission that an individual who purchases a firearm for a third party, but who intentionally states on a Form 4473 that he's the actual buyer of the firearm, violates both 922A6 and 924A1A, even if both parties, both buyers, are eligible to purchase a firearm. And the reason is this, is that the firearm statute in Section 921 broadly regulates the commerce in firearms, it regulates firearms, it prohibits certain individuals from possessing a firearm, it also imposes a lot of record-keeping duties on federal firearms dealers. And that is designed
as... But the value being protected here is what? Just having somebody tell the truth?
Telling the truth is an extremely important value, and it is...
I didn't say that it wasn't, but I'm asking you, what. That seems to me the only value that's being protected here is telling the truth.
Telling the truth is an important value. As the Supreme Court once indicated,
Nobody's arguing with that, but I'm asking you, what other values being protected other than that?
The administrative concerns that are present on the 4473, it is the primary reason that the government can trace firearms that have subsequently been used in a crime. And if it happens, for example, that a buyer who is qualified purchases a gun for another buyer who may be also qualified, but who might want to use the gun for a bad purpose and use
it. Yeah, that all sounds fine, but had the arrangement for this gun to go to his uncle, happen 1 second after the purchase, you wouldn't have any better chance of tracing it than what this guy did.
It may be a little bit of truth, Judge Shedd, in any particular individual case in which the facts are a little bit in the defendant's favor. And obviously the government is not going to say in this particular case that this is the worst case of a prohibited buyer, I'm sorry, of a purchaser buying a gun for another person.
Is it the least worst case you've ever seen?
I'm not sure it is the least worst case anyway.
You
but
think of one worse, I mean, one any less damaging than this one? The guy could buy it. The person who got it could have it, mm-hmm. and no chicanery involved other than the form.
Mm-hmm.
What can you think of a less damaging case than this to your understanding of the statute?
There might be some hypothetically that I could think of, and for example, where the gun that was immediately given to the third party somehow was put in a mattress and never used again and things like that. I will acknowledge that. But
well,
the value.
You know the gun was ever used again?
I don't have any knowledge of what happened.
We have the mattress case then. I'm just thinking it's interesting to me. You can't think of a less damaging case than this one because it's hard to think of.
Right. When you're using the word damaging, Judge Shedd, you're not using the word damaging in the sense that it is damaging to the values under 922A6.
I'm talking about the real purpose of the statute, right, other than truth-telling.
That
makes sense what I'm saying to you.
I understand, Judge Shedd, and I will acknowledge to you, as the Fifth Circuit said in Polk, that the primary purpose of 922, when it was enacted, was to prevent prohibited persons from acquiring firearms. That was the overriding purpose. Fully agree with you on
and
that.
And we don't have a prohibited person here.
And
don't
prohibit it here.
Right. On the other hand, one of the purposes in enacting the false statement statutes was primarily designed, again, to ensure that the government would have these accountability and record-keeping provisions so that the government would be able to know who, in every case, is acquiring a firearm. And that's extremely important.
But I mean, you know it in this case.
We do know it in this case, but again, when in deciding cases, when Congress enacted a statute like this and put a number of...
I know all that, but you said the purpose is to know who acquired the firearm. You know it. You know who acquired
right.
it.
But not only do we know it now, but one of the purposes of having an over-the-counter sale be filled out with a 4473 and then sent for a background check is that the Congress wanted the federal firearms dealer to make that determination in the first instance. And it's going to be difficult in the regular case for a firearms dealer to determine who is the actual purchaser.
I know
of the
that,
firearm.
But listen to me, though, Mr. Booth.
All right, I'm...
Had the arrangement not been made until one nanosecond after he signed that form, there would be no violation of the statute, correct?
Now, if by 1 second you mean that he purchased the firearm for his own particular
That's
purposes.
Correct.
And then
one nanosecond later, he worked out the arrangement to sell it to his uncle.
Right.
You wouldn't have any better tracing position then than you have now.
It is true, and again, in a particular individual case, Judge Shedd,
well,
as you...
I'm not talking about in a particular individual. I'm talking about in this one under the hypothetical I gave you.
The statute, both statutes as enacted, were designed to allow the federal firearms dealer mm-hmm. to make that determination at the time and not to have either me or a court of appeals or a judge after the fact say, well, it turns out everything was okay because we know now that he didn't use it.
Because there's not any indication in this situation, not any indication that the federal firearms dealer would have done anything differently had he known the arrangement. Other than he still would have known who it was going to, but there was no prohibited person involved.
But under the form itself, you look at the form. The form says if you are not the actual buyer, this is not a valid sale. The dealer cannot give you that firearm. And here's the reason the dealer can't, why it would be unlawful.
Is nationwide, is this a major thrust of the Department of Justice to prosecute people who have, by happenstance, a prearranged sale to another qualified buyer in the family? That's a major thrust of enforcement of this statute around the country.
The major thrust for straw purchases, absolutely. And straw purchases are prosecuted all
the time. I
didn't
say that. You changed my question. I didn't say that. I said a purchase to hand over to another qualified family member. I said, is that a major thrust of the Department of Justice?
It is a thrust of the...
You know another case like this?
I haven't seen a particular case.
I didn't think you would have. I didn't think you would have. So you think it is just basically, although it serves valid purposes, it really is a technical violation. You agree with that?
In the sense that any false statement where there is no other tangible injury to the government, You could say that it is a technical violation, but technical violations are prosecuted,
right,
and those are legitimate prosecutions. Many false statements, for example. I mean, again,
you don't want to just say to Judge Shedd, Judge, we think this guy was dirty, and this was all we could get on him.
That happens a lot.
Isn't that what's going on here?
Prosecutors make those decisions, don't they, Mr. Booth?
Prosecutors make those decisions on a number of factors.
If you have a weak bank robbery case, and a strong straw purchase case, you might want to prosecute the strong straw purchase case and get the thing over with. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but prosecutors have to make those decisions every day.
There's nothing of a court of appeal. That's purely an executive.
Vested in the executive branch, in the attorney general, and in this case, in the United States Attorney for Western Virginia.
And Judge Ives, I would mention perhaps you were thinking of the Al Capone case, in which the government could only get him for income tax evasion.
Al Capone is always floating over every criminal case in federal court.
But as long as you brought it up, I thought I would mention it. To go back, Judge Shedd.
Just let me say this. I was leading you up to the stream, trying to suggest you might want to drink, and Judge Davis pushed you right in the middle of it. But apparently, standing knee-deep in it, you still don't see the water, do you? Or you won't tell us there's any water there, will you?
Judge, as a fact, I just don't know.
You have any hunch?
You hunch. I want to go back to the points you've mentioned, Judge, about false statements. There's a long line of Supreme Court cases, and I cited a couple of them in my brief, about the integrity of official inquiries. And the government has the right to ask, when they ask you certain questions, they can force you, in a sense, tell you have to answer them truthfully.
That's what
you
they
can't lie.
Statute on that we used to use all the time, 1001.
1001 is one example.
Part of the lingo. If you can't get them for anything else, get them for a 1001 violation, right?
You can, and for example, the Supreme Court had held in the Hagen case that it is, for example, it is not a defense to a 1001 violation, that it was sort of harmless error, that the statement that you made to the police officer or to the investigating officer
I ask you, were you protecting any other interest other than the truth? That's the first question that I ask you, if you remember.
Yes.
And it seems to me that's what you've come back to.
I've said that is the primary one, but again, the record keeping provisions of the statute would fall and would be virtually unenforceable if people were allowed to purchase firearms for others.
I don't remember. Did the government object or recommend a sentence other than what the defendant got in this case?
It's in the record, but I just off the top of my head don't remember. But again, he got 5 years probation on both counts, so there's no jail time here. But again, if the government's record keeping provisions in this statute began to be riddled with errors, and again, what you might say technical errors because the person who purchased the gun gave it to a family member, and so no harm was done, no prohibited person.
What I'm calling a technical error is just when you make an error that's clear. I want to define that. It's just an error that's clear on the face of the document. That's what I'm calling. It can still be very material. I'm just saying, that's why I asked the other side, and they sort of didn't quite want to answer the question, but he clearly made an error based on the form itself. He was not the actual buyer as that is defined on the form, right?
That is correct.
That's what I'm calling a technical error.
And I don't describe this as an error because that form, both on the opening provision, which talks about actual buyer,
you call it an error. I call it an error just to mean that it's wrong.
Wrong, but wrong in the sense that the government doesn't set traps for the unwary in this particular case, because that form, both on its face in the check that he had to mark on question one, and then again on the examples in question 11, make it quite clear that the government is going to let you know and provide you with all the opportunity to provide the right answer instead of the wrong answer. And when you look at that form and you say, I'm not the actual buyer, then all you do at that particular point is that you go in and bring in the other qualified purchaser and he fills out the form. One point I'd like to mention to you, Judge Shedd, is that just because an individual is a qualified purchaser for a firearm, that is a necessary but it's not a sufficient condition to enable you to buy a firearm. I mean, even if there's no prohibition, you're not a felon, you don't have a dishonorable discharge or whatever.
But you have to have the money to?
And you have to, you have money, but nevertheless, you have to accurately fill out the form. And the reason why a misstatement as to the actual buyer is material to the lawfulness of the sale is because, as the Ninth Circuit in Johnson and the Eleventh Circuit in Nelson went through in some detail, under 922b5, the federal firearms dealer has to, by law, record your name, your address, and your date of birth on a form that's required to be kept under the statute. And 922g1a states that these forms have to be maintained in accordance with regulations by the Attorney General. The Attorney General has implemented 28 CFR 428, which deals with 4473, and in turn, 4473 says you have to say that you're the actual buyer. So if you misstate who the actual buyer is, when the federal firearms dealer fills out the form under 922b5, he's not putting down the right name, and so therefore it's an unlawful sale. And that's why the misstatement as to the actual buyer is material to the lawfulness of the sale. Now, we submit that there are two courts of appeals that rule in our favor. There's one court of appeals that is against us. I would like to explain to you why we think the Polk decision was incorrectly decided. Two things that the Polk decision did that we think was an error. First was a textual error. In quoting from the statute under 922A6, the court specifically referred to the lawfulness of the sale and did not italicize the term material, which we consider the most important part of the statute. So there was an error there because it tended to look at whether each individual could buy the firearm. That was a mistake. The second mistake was a citation mistake because they cited the Supreme Court's decision in Barrett for the overriding purpose of 922A6. But if you look at footnote 2 in Barrett, the Supreme Court didn't decide any question of 922A6 at all. So in our submission, the Polk decision was wrong. The Frazier decision and the Morales decision are correct, and we urge you to follow them. But even if you were to follow the Polk rationale, that simply would not apply to Abramski's conviction under 924A1A, because, again, that statute simply makes it a defense to make a false statement in connection with records that have to be kept. And it's pretty obvious. The Johnson case, the most recent decision from the Ninth Circuit, goes into this at length and indicates that a false statement as to who the actual buyer is on a 4473 violates that statute. So our submission is that both statutes were violated in this particular case, and therefore you should affirm them. I have just a few minutes left. Do you have any particular questions with respect to the search?
What's your, you don't like the Polk case.
Right.
What's the best case of the ones that agree with you?
Frazier and Frazier, the 11th Circuit case, which we've cited at length, which the decision which specifically pointed out what we consider to be the errors that were committed in Polk. And then the Morales case, it was decided just a couple of months ago that I, a 28J letter to this court a few weeks ago,
Sixth Circuit,
which specifically follows Frazier. So the trend in the circuits is away from Polk and towards the position that
and
we are from.
And I assume there have been some district courts that have dealt with this too, right?
There have been a few district court decisions. There have been a lot of other courts of appeals decisions that have dealt with the buyer who is eligible to purchase a firearm, but who makes a false statement as to either his name or his street address. And in those cases, they have found a violation of 922A6, even though that person was eligible to purchase a firearm. Well, it seems to us that the rules should be the same in both cases. If the person who's eligible to buy a firearm makes a misstatement as to his identity, and there's no other third party involved, and he is convicted under 922A6, an eligible purchaser who makes a false statement and he's getting it for another eligible purchaser, he should also be guilty of violating 922A6.
The mistake as to address, is that material or an error as to record keeping?
I'm sorry, Judge Shedd.
The mistake as to the address you just mentioned,
mm-hmm.
That is a mistake that involves materiality, or is that a mistake that involves record keeping?
No, that also involves materiality, because that would also affect the lawfulness of the sale. And that's because 922b5 says that the federal firearms dealer has to record the name, age, and place of residence of such person. There's actually a Seventh Circuit case.
Did you ever have a record-keeping violation that wasn't material?
There could be. For example, 4473 requires you to list your height and weight, and I suppose if you missed those, that would not affect the lawfulness of the sale. It is the name, age, and place of residence that are something I said that wasn't.
I was going to think it.
The only mistake might be a defense. I mean, it has to be a false statement.
It has to be willful.
It has to be a willful,
willful statement.
So a mistake might be a defense.
Absolutely.
It's right. Misspoke, it might be a defense. Didn't remember your name, maybe.
Right. I mean, that is why the some of the arguments the other side has made in this case about whether he had the intent or not. If he really believed that he was simply making a mistake in this case or whatever, he could have gone to trial. Although, as I indicated in a footnote in my brief, specific intent to violate the law is not a defense, and neither is estoppel by representation. I mean, it's not a defense to say a couple of federal firearms dealers told me I could go make a false statement on the form, or I could buy the firearm and I could list myself as being the actual buyer, even though I had a prearrangement to give it to somebody else and that would be legal. I mean, the federal firearms form, which is based on the CFR regulation, which in turn is commanded by the 922 G1A, which says that these records will be kept by the Attorney General. That's why that form is extremely important. And again, Judge Shedd, that's the primary reason that they trace these weapons.
Your understanding is what is preserved by the conditional plea. It can't be any defense that he might have or lack of specific intent.
I agree with you, Judge Shedd.
It could be preserved as to the motion to suppress. That makes sense to me, mm-hmm. because if the government doesn't have the weapon, then you have no case. But otherwise, the only thing it can be on this statute or these statutes is just under the facts as they exist, whether or not that is a violation of reading of the statute. Isn't that the only thing that's preserved on that front?
There were a couple of question and answers during the Rule 11 inquiry where the defense attorney questioned the defendant about what he understood the scope of the his plea agreement was going to be. And there's a hint that it may have encompassed a couple of these things, and I was a little leery about making the strong argument that these were.
Would that be a proper conditional plea then?
Maybe we don't have jurisdiction.
Would that be?
You have jurisdiction because you do have jurisdiction, Judge King, because the question as to whether or not 922A6 and 924A1A apply on the facts of this case, whether they apply to this kind, that's clearly a matter of law, and that's preserved.
But you said, no, I thought you just said you didn't want to go that far because in the plea colloquy, he said that the lawyer said something that gives you pause. I thought that's what you just told us.
It's a little odd, and that's why in a footnote I indicated that those arguments were totally without merit, but those are defenses that should have been raised.
But there was an effort to preserve something else on the question of the record keeping and the form. Is this a proper conditional plea?
We have jurisdiction over the search.
Yes, that was
no
clear.
You
have a question about that.
The search warrant.
It was essential. The seizure here
they
resulted in
issues in connection with the search warrant and the seizure. Mm-hmm.
That is correct,
you
Judge.
You can't get here on a conditional plea.
You can on a search warrant if the search and seizure result in the seizure of essential evidence.
That would be the only thing that would be in front of us then. It couldn't raise, then they would enter a guilty plea subject to the condition question about the search warrant. That would be the only issue in front of us. I don't understand what you're saying. You can't have a conditional plea where there are factual issues yet to be determined.
That's true. The plea agreement did permit the defendant to appeal from the denial of the judge's ruling with respect to the applicability of the statutes to his conduct. And so you have jurisdiction on that.
But just let me ask one question. Mm-hmm. My understanding, though, of a conditional plea, it has to be that a determination on the record as it stands mm-hmm. ends the case if the defendant's wrong.
Right. If he's wrong, well, as I said, the intent issues that are virtually, in our view, I only put them in footnote, they're not worth anything in our view. I have no time left, but I will answer any questions you've got. Thank you.
I just want to mention very quickly, this is beyond trivial, but your table of contents in your brief somehow got skewed, and the page citations don't match up to the actual citations in the brief. I just mentioned that in case it's some kind of systemic problem in your office.
I will go back and take a look at that. I'll take a look at that. I tend to look at them early, right?
Yeah. Polk is not cited on page 13. It's cited on page 11, not 13. Just take a look at it. That's all.
And therefore, you lose.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Booth. Good to have you.
Blame the word process.
Ms. Overstreet.
And with that statement, maybe I should have remained seated.
Therefore, you lose.
In that case, well, just...
We blame you because you didn't write.
Right, that's my defense. I'll call Mr. Cleveland. We lost because...
We'll get Judge Cleveland up here.
Judge Cleveland. I want you to go respond to that. Just briefly, one thing I did want to address. The government this morning has put some significant emphasis on the record-keeping part of this and the importance of that. And one of the hypotheticals, I believe it was Judge Shedd raised, is, you know, if Mr. Obransky had just walked out and 2 seconds later had given the gun, transferred the gun to a stranger, say, for instance, me, somebody he doesn't know, you know, before all of this, in that case...
That wasn't really Judge... I don't... Maybe Judge Shedd knows better than you and I would, but I thought he walked out... And then made the decision
to transfer it.
He hadn't
exactly
made the decision that's, when he got it.
Correct. That's what I mean.
Because under that scenario that Judge Shedd posited, it was not a straw purchase.
Correct.
Under the scenario that is presented here, it was a straw purchase.
But with these facts, we have more record keeping here because it's not a stranger. It's not someone that didn't then follow up and do a proper transfer with the paperwork through a dealer. I mean, what we have here is another layer of information, again, that I would submit to the court, is the information that this statute is designed to protect. We want to know whose hands the firearm is in. Whose hands? In this case, we know, without question.
No, your client would not have to have told who it went to, though.
Correct.
So I think you're wrong about, you know, you might have more in this one application, but under the general fact, you don't necessarily have more. As a general rule, you have less.
But under these facts, we do have more because they went to a dealer in Pennsylvania, filled out all the paperwork, wanted to be sure they did this correctly. In my experience with all the clients that I've represented through the years, when they want to break the law, they typically don't go and ask somebody how to do it correctly.
There should have been a trial, and you could argue that kind of stuff.
Exactly. I was thinking this would be a good case for jury nullification, wouldn't it?
You would love to argue this case to a jury. Yes,
ladies and
dance around
in Western
case.
Virginia?
Yes, I would love to have argued this case to a jury. It would have been a very interesting argument. I will agree with you, Your Honor.
What was the paperwork that was executed in Pennsylvania? Was that another 4473?
In the record, I don't believe
there's reference to paperwork.
Paperwork. There was never the specific forms and so forth, Your Honor, were never specifically submitted into the record, only the general references.
But your position is they had to search his home and dig the receipt out of a bank?
Green bag.
Mm-hmm. Green bank bag, cash bag, or whatever it was.
Yes.
To find out who the person was that ended up with the gun.
Right. Which kind of undercuts the point
that it's all open and notorious because of the transaction up in Pennsylvania. They had to dig it out of his house, out of that bag, which you're saying was an illegal Fourth Amendment seizure.
But that's the only reason we're here, is because they illegally seized that receipt out of that bank bag.
But you don't contend that the warrant didn't authorize a search for ammunition, right?
No, I mean, that's specifically listed. Yes, I think that's number 9.
Couldn't ammunition have been hidden in that bank bag?
I would submit to Your Honor, if you see the bank bag and you touch it and you pick it up, you're going to know. At that point, I don't think a reasonable person would conclude, using common sense and reasonable prudence, that you can find ammunition in a bank bag.
But does that make it an unlawful seizure?
I think it does when the search warrant specifically says we are not interested in getting that bank bag.
No, they said they're not interested in getting the bag they already had.
We're not interested in getting the bank bag.
That warrant affidavit doesn't say we're not interested in any other green bank bags. It said we already got one green bank bag.
They had from the...
And we're not going to search for that one.
Yes, we're not going to search for green bank bags.
No, for that green bank bag. They didn't make a promise that they weren't going to seize any other bank bags.
I would submit respectfully that it's a matter of interpretation, but I would submit that's what was intended.
There's another green bank bag in there. They'd want to take that back to the headquarters and see if they could draw some fingerprints off of it, or DNA, or even if it didn't have anything in it. In fact, this had in it a reference to uncle up in Pennsylvania.
If that's what they, I would submit, if that's what they were intending to go in there and hoping to find and so forth, they should have just completely left any reference to the green bag at the Callaway residence out of this search warrant. I think that creates a problem.
I just observe, I always thought if they were there lawfully and they run into evidence of a crime, they're derelict if they don't take it. That's always been my view of what the way policemen ought to be when they're conducting a search that's been ordered by a judge. Here, they had a search warrant issued by a federal judge, and they needed to go execute it promptly and do it right. Anyway.
If it were evidence of a crime.
That's an aside, and that's all dicta.
Thank you very much for your time.
Except, therefore, you lose.
And therefore, I'll go call Mr. Cleveland.
Ms. Overstreet, we want to specifically thank you for taking over this case at this stage of the case.
Certainly.
That you came into it and handling it as a court-appointed lawyer. And you've done a fine job, and we appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Thank you
for your
time. We
couldn't operate without lawyers like you that would do this.
Glad to do the job. I enjoy it. Thank you very much.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then call the next case.